Children and Families Finance and Policy. Welcome. I'm Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the committee. And welcome to members of the public who are joining us online and in the audience here. Just a reminder that our meeting materials are posted on our website. And greetings to members as well. We're going to start, as usual, by having the clerk call the roll. So, Ms. Kahn, if you could please do that.
Chair Pinto?
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler?
Present.
Lee Daniels?
Yeah, he is excused.
Representative Bliss?
Present.
Representative Coulter?
Present.
Representative Davis?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Hemmingson Yeager?
Present.
Representative Hicks?
Present.
Representative Hudson?
Present.
Representative Katiza Watun? Representative Lee?
Present.
Representative Nelson?
Present.
And Representative Pettis Vega is excused.
We have a quorum.
Lesnikar.
Oh, it's Lesnikar. I thought you missed one.
Representative
Lesnikar. Here.
Okay, good. No thank you, Representative Lesnikar. I thought we had one more after Perez Vega. So we do have a quorum. We will be doing our meeting minutes, approving them at our next meeting is the plan. Members, today we are going to be receiving an overview from House Research on a couple of parts of our committee jurisdiction, and then also receiving a presentation, actually the first that any legislative committee will have been receiving from the Mara Office of Legislative Auditor on a child protection report that they came out with in the summer. So looking forward to that. I want to just handle a couple of preliminary issues for all of us. In your committee packets are committee rules. And so I'm not going to walk through them individually, but just would ask members certainly to take the time yourselves to do so. You'll see that rule number one is respect, which is the most important rule in the committee. I'll certainly try to show that to all of you and would ask folks to show that to one another and to testifiers, members of the public, et cetera. Folks should let me know, members should, if you have questions about the rules. There's a series of, there's some deadlines regarding amendments and testifiers, et cetera. And again, we'll try to be respectful of everyone as we try to work through this process. I should maybe ask if folks have any questions as to the rules at this point. They're certainly open to them at any other time. So, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, is remote testimony allowed? I don't know if I see that in here, but I think that could be potentially a positive thing for, especially our further out state able to do so.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Nelson. I should say that that's been expressed as an interest by a number of members as well. And I know that Vice Chair Keeler especially, that's been an important issue too as well. I'm very hopeful we'll be able to have remote testimony. The challenge is the hearing room. So the one that can do that is hearing room 120 in the Capitol, which is used by another committee at this point. And so there's just the one room. So what I'm anticipating is that sort of at the appropriate time for an appropriate bill, it may make sense for us to meet in that room to allow that testimony. I should say I'd like to do that as much as we possibly can. The one thing is I suspect that we sort of have a limited number of shots at that room. I will say if members are aware of something coming up or an issue that you think that would be particularly appropriate for that bill, and again, as compared to others, because I don't think we could do it very many times, let's talk about that. But yeah, thank you for raising that, because that is definitely an interest of other members as well. Yeah, thanks. But that's why it's not referenced in these particular rules, just because they'll be so limited. So anything else from members about the rules? Not seeing anything at this point. Again, plenty of other opportunities. Our committee jurisdiction will be connected to members, the Children and Family Services Division of the Department of Human Services. We'll hear more details about that as time goes on. And there's still a few small details that we're working out. I'm going to be asking House Research to walk through some aspects of a couple pieces of our work. Before I do that, though, I actually want to ground us in a particular piece that's particularly important to me, and I hope to members as well, which is to acknowledge that where we are right now, where we're meeting, are the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Dakota, Lakota, Nakota people, territory that was 100% ceded by treaty. And our U.S. Constitution declares the treaties are supreme, and we all, members of the House, swear an oath to uphold it, and yet this House and our government, more broader government in many cases, have violated those treaty rights and caused great harm to the members of Minnesota's 11 sovereign tribal nations, and especially to children and families, which is, of course, important for the work of this committee. And these are harms that reverberate today. I highlight this right now because especially the child protection presentation we'll be receiving later is especially connected to that. I expect that we're going to be holding as a full house another tribal sovereignty day as we've done in the past so that we all can learn more and commit to do better. But in the meantime, I hope that all of us are committed as I am to rectifying these injustices, to upholding tribal sovereignty and ensuring that indigenous kids and families, but all kids and families in our state have the support that they need to thrive. And so for me, that's a grounding that's especially important. I hope that that is true for all members of the committee as well. And that brings us then into the presentation from Ms. Mock and Ms. Sunderman on a couple of aspects of our committee's work. One of those is early childhood, and then the other is child protection. And so again, there's other pieces as well, and we'll discuss that as things move forward. Ms. Mock, I suspect you're probably the first one to be up, and so if you can please start walking us through your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. I'm Annie Mock with House Research, and Ms. Sunderman and I are going to walk through some of the programs that are in this committee's jurisdiction. It's going to be a very high-level overview of these programs. I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about them as session goes on. So I'm going to start with the programs that are early childhood programs. These were all programs that were in the committee's jurisdiction in previous years when this committee was the Early Childhood Committee. And then Ms. Sunderman will go through the child protection provisions. And I should just quickly note, I'm going to mention program costs here and there, but this is not a fiscal presentation. Mr. Berg and Ms. Beckel will be providing fiscal information at a later date to the committee.
And Ms. Mock, thanks for highlighting that. So members, this is really on the programmatic side. As we kind of finalize the exact details of jurisdiction, there are several committees that also have jurisdiction over Department of Human Services. I'll be asking our fiscal staff to provide an overview for us of the dollar figures. But for now, we're just going to get the programmatic presentation. So Ms. Mock, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All the programs I'm going to go over are either administered by the Department of Education, MDE, or DHS. And I'm going to start with the MDE provisions. So we'll start with something probably most of you with children are familiar with. This is the Developmental Screening Program. This is school districts must offer developmental screening for children before they start kindergarten. So that screening is targeted at children between the ages of 3 and 5. And school districts receive money for each child screened to help cover the costs of that program. School districts may but are not required to offer a kindergarten readiness assessment to incoming kindergartners. And there is a small amount of money in the base for this program. There are several grant programs administered by MDE that have been in this committee's jurisdiction in the past. One of those is called Parent Child Plus. This is a grant to Jewish Community Services to operate a literacy program, literacy home visiting program for parents and children. Another program is Reach Out and Read, which is a literacy organization that provides books and other literacy-related materials to pediatricians and other medical offices serving children. Another program is Early Childhood Family Education, more commonly known as ECFE. School districts may operate ECFE programs for children and their parents and expectant parents. These are programs that children and parents attend together, and there is a strong parent education component to these programs. Next, we'll go over Head Start. Head Start is a federal program that provides comprehensive family-oriented services to children from low-income families. The Head Start program has actually multiple programs. Head Start primarily serves is a preschool program for 3 and 4 year olds. Early Head Start is programs for infants, toddlers, and expectant parents. And then there's also a tribal Head Start program, which is essentially Head Start and early Head Start programs operated by tribal governments or organizations. Head Start programs are primarily funded with federal money. However, there is a state appropriation for Head Start programs. That appropriation has been in place for many years. Now I'm going to talk about three programs that sound very similar and are very easy to confuse. They are School Readiness, Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten, and School Readiness Plus. These are all state-established preschool programs. So I'll start with School Readiness. So school districts may establish a school readiness program for 3 and 4 year old children for the purpose of preparing these kids for kindergarten. The program must be free for children who have a specified risk factor, and there are a number of risk factors in statute. They include things like being eligible for free and reduced price lunch, or being homeless, or having a risk factor that could influence learning. So money for the School Readiness Plus programs is allocated to school districts according to a statutory formula. And that formula is in part based on the number of children in a school district who are eligible for free and reduced price meals. So the next two preschool programs are Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten and School Readiness Plus. Both of these programs are for children who are 4 years old at the start of the school year. Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten is free for all children. School Readiness Plus is free to children who have a specified risk factor, like the School Readiness Program. I'm going to skip to the bottom bullet on the slide. Money for the programs is actually appropriated through the General Education Aid formula, and both programs are capped by number of seats. So there are 3,160 voluntary pre-kindergarten seats, and there are 4,000 School Readiness Plus seats. And those seats are allocated among school districts and charter schools according to a formula that takes into account the number of children in a school that are eligible for free and reduced price meals. One thing to note about the seats is that the funding for the 3,160 voluntary pre-kindergarten seats is ongoing, but the funding for the School Readiness Plus seats, the current funding that's available, ends at the end of this fiscal year. So the 4,000 School Readiness Plus seats will expire unless the legislature acts to extend the funding for those seats.
And Ms. Mock, I'm going to pause you, assuming you're about to switch to another slide. Just to note for members that this piece, this slide, we do have jurisdiction over these programs, but the reference to the General Education Aid formula means that the actual funding will pass through the Education Finance Committee chaired by Chair Joachim. Because that funding formula is kind of overseen by that committee. So the rest of these programs are overseen by our committee. This one, there's a little bit of a shared jurisdiction. So just so folks understand that, the jurisdictional issue. And be looking for a proposal. I'm certainly interested in extending those expiring seats, but we'll talk about that as bills move along. So Ms. Mock, please continue.
Thank you. All right, the next program is the Early Learning Scholarships Program. This is another state-established program. This is a program for 3 and 4-year-old children from low-income families. But this program has some exceptions to allow younger kids to get scholarships. And there are two types of scholarships. Pathway 1 scholarships are awarded directly to eligible children, and they can be used at any parent-aware rated child care early learning program chosen by the child's family. And I'm going to talk about Parent Aware in a few minutes, but that is the state's quality rating system for child care programs and early learning programs. So those Pathway 1 scholarships go directly to children, and then the children can use them at a program of their choice or the family's choice. Pathway 2 scholarships are awarded to early care and learning programs that have 4-star ratings. That's the highest rating from Parent Aware. And then those programs are use that scholarship money to create seats in their programs for scholarship eligible children. All right, so that's the end of the MDE administered programs. I'm going to move on to the DHS administered programs. I'm going to start with Child Care Assistance, or CCAP. This is a federal state program. It's related to TANFs or MFIP in Minnesota. It reduces child care expenses for low-income eligible families according to a sliding fee scale. A child's eligibility for this program is dependent on parents working or seeking employment or being involved in training or educational activities. CCAP serves a sort of a broader age range of kids than the other programs I've just described. This CCAP is for children from 0 to 13 years old or 15 if a child has a disability. CCAP is essentially a federal block grant program, so the state sets rules for the program within the parameters defined by the federal government. And CCAP is funded with federal, state, and county money. Next, I'll talk about child care licensing. So any entity that is providing child care services in the state must be licensed or specifically excluded from licensure. So operating a child care program without being licensed or without being exempt from licensure is a misdemeanor in the state. And I should note, I'm talking about the state licensing process for child care here. Tribal governments can also license tribal child care programs, and that is separate from what I'm talking about here. Licensing is a really big, complex topic, and I'm going to barely scratch the surface of it here. But I just want to mention a couple things. One, I just want to reiterate what I just said. There is a requirement to be licensed in the state or to be specifically excluded from licensure. I think some people don't recognize that there are programs that do not have to be licensed to operate in the state. And those programs, I'm using that word loosely, But those are people like if grandma is taking care of her grandchildren, she does not need to be licensed. Religious education programs like Sunday school do not need to be licensed. Certain parks and recs programs don't need to be licensed to operate in the state and care for kids. Another thing to note about licensing, there's two primary licensing types. There are licenses for child care centers, and then there are licenses for family or group family child cares. And the licensing requirements are similar but not the same for these two different types of licenses. So, for example, child care centers and family child care providers both have to comply with, like, group size requirements, the number of kids they can have in their program, and the child-to-adult ratios for the programs. But those requirements look different whether it's a center or whether it's a family child care provider. And then I also want to note that the 2021 legislature directed DHS to do a number of, do some work looking at the licensing requirements in the state. And that work, some of that work has, I think, just been completed and some of it is ongoing. So one thing was, it's called an alternative child care licensing model. DHS was directed to look at licensing requirements in other states and consider whether those licensing requirements could be implemented in Minnesota without affecting the health and safety of children. And I believe that that work is complete and the legislature should be receiving a report from DHS soon on that study. The other thing that's going on right now is a regulation modernization project where DHS contracted with an organization to develop new licensing models for both child care centers and family child care providers. And that work is ongoing, and it's supposed to be concluded, and DHS is expected to report on it February of next year, so February 2024.
And members, I expect to be asking for a short update on those, on kind of what the status is of those licensing studies relatively soon. So Ms. Summerfield will be in touch about that. So Ms. Mock, please continue.
Thank you. Next, we'll talk about Parent Aware. I mentioned this earlier. This is the state's voluntary quality rating and improvement system for child care programs and early learning programs. So child care programs, early learning programs can choose to be rated. It's a 4-star rating with 4 stars being the highest rating. And then if they're rated, there are certain benefits. Early learning scholarships are only available to programs that are rated. The CCAP program pays a higher rate to programs that have 3 or 4 star ratings. And the point of the quality rating and improvement system is it's a way for our state to assess and communicate the level of quality in the state's child care and early learning programs. And one thing that I didn't put on the slide that I should just note is that the 2021 legislature also directed DHS to evaluate this program, and that evaluation is going on now, I believe. And specifically, the legislature directed DHS to evaluate how the program, how Parent Aware impacts children's progress towards school readiness, and also how it impacts just the quality and supply of child care and early learning programs in the state. That work is expected to be completed, and DHS is expected to report back to the legislature in December of 2024, so about a year and a half or 2 years from now. All right, my last slide. Just like MDE, there are a number of grant programs administered by DHS that have been before this committee in the past. I'm not going to go through all of these. There's a lot here. But most of these grant programs are directed at the child care and early learning workforce or infrastructure needs in the sector. And the other thing I'll note about these programs is most of them were most recently funded with federal COVID relief dollars. And so to the extent that these programs, anyone wants these programs to continue, you will likely hear about them this session. And with that, if it's all right with the chair, I will turn it over to Ms. Sunderman.
I'm actually going to pause just to see if members, so Ms. Mock has done an amazing job. Thank you, Ms. Mock, summarizing these programs. There's a ton of detail beneath them. We will be hearing more, and I know Ms. Mock will be available to members to work on them further. Are there any initial questions that folks have regarding these programs? And not seeing anything, so then in that case, we will, in fact, move to Ms. Sunderman, also from House Research. And thanks so much, Ms. Sunderman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Sunderman from House Research. And as Ms. Mock said, I'll be doing a very, very high level overview of sort of child protection, child welfare system in Minnesota. And I believe you'll hear significantly more detail in the presentation following regarding the OLA report.
And I will note that part of that OLA presentation will also discuss child protection system in general. So these should be a nice, they should link together nicely. So, yeah, thank you, Ms. Sunderman. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members, so federal law requires each state to provide intervention and services to protect children from abuse and neglect, and the state legislature establishes the policy to implement federal law and provide services to families. The primary chapters in statute regarding child protection are chapters 260E, which covers maltreatment of minors, and chapter 260C. There are other relevant provisions in chapter 260, including the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, which is sort of the state version of the federal Indian Child Welfare Act. And then funding for services comes from federal, county, and state sources. We'll start with the Maltreatment of Minors Act, which is chapter 260E. So any person may voluntarily report known or suspected maltreatment. There are, however, mandatory reporters who must report suspected or known maltreatment in the preceding 3 years to the local welfare agency, which is typically the county, but also can be the tribe, and to applicable law enforcement or another responsible agency. Counties provide services when a child is alleged to have been maltreated in the home. And there are two different paths that this can take. This is either a family assessment or a family investigation. Law enforcement investigates reports that allege criminal violations, and they do this in cooperation with county agencies. When a caregiver outside of the home is alleged to have maltreated a child, the responsible agency investigates. This can be DHS. If it's in a DHS licensed facility, it can be MDE. And I believe it can also be Department of Corrections. After a maltreatment report, if a child is not safe in a home or a parent has not cooperated with a service plan in a family assessment or investigation, a county may file a child in need of protection or services case. This is commonly known as a CHIPS case. In this situation, it gets a lot more complex and each case is different. But typically, a child is placed in foster care, whether that's with a family member or a non-family foster care provider. A case plan is developed to attempt to reunify the family within 6 to 12 months, and there are review hearings for the case every 3 months. If the home remains unsafe after the child is in foster care for 11 months, the county will file a permanency petition. Again, this varies a lot depending on the situation, but this is the sort of statutory path. Permanency can be a termination of parental rights, otherwise known as a TPR, and a subsequent adoption of the child. Can be guardianship to the Commissioner of Human Services, that is adoption with parental consent. Or a transfer of permanent legal and physical custody to a relative. This is commonly referred to as a kinship placement. Reunification may also be a permanency option if the court determines that the home is safe and reunifying with the family is in the child's best interest. And all of these decisions along the way are required to be based on the child's best interests, which are spelled out in statute. And my final slide is about North Star Care for Children. This is the funding program that provides monthly assistance payments to children and for children in foster care and children who are adopted or whose custody is transferred to a relative in a kinship placement. Kinship or adoption assistance eligibility determinations are started by the county or tribal staff, and the final determination is made by DHS. Payments are based on age, and supplemental payments are based on the child's assessed special needs. And that is the very quick, very high-level wrap-up of child protection.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. Yes, you both had a really impossible job and did it really, really well, so thank you. And members, there's, if anything, even more detail beneath these slides underneath them than the first area. Are there questions about them at this point, about this area? We'll be, again, pivoting to our early report in just a second. So early childhood, child protection, child welfare, and then there are other pieces related to economic supports for families that we'll be addressing at a later point, and again, hearing from our fiscal staff. What I'm inclined to do then, unless I'm just checking to see if there's anybody has any questions or anything, then in that case, this has been a great orientation. Thank you both so much. And so we will bring up our representative from the Office of Legislative Auditor, Mr. Kirshner, and come on up. And if you can please introduce yourself, and just before you begin, again, I'll note members, this is a report that came out last summer, but because of the timing of the report, it has not been presented to any legislative committee before now. I should note child protection is an area, notice all the talk about courts, et cetera. We kind of share jurisdiction with the Judiciary Committee. So that's another piece of this, but it seemed important to me that we should right away get to have this report get aired publicly before a legislative committee, and we'll kind of see what we want to do with it from there. So in any case, please introduce yourself and begin with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this report. My name is David Kirshner. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I'm very pleased to be here. Before I get started with our presentation, I would just like to say a word or two about the Legislative Auditor's Office, since I know that we have a lot of new members on this committee. We are a nonpartisan, independent office that works for the legislature, and we provide, hopefully, the tools for the legislature to have increased oversight and hold state agencies and others to more accountability to the legislature for the work that they do. We release program evaluations, which was one, financial audits, information technology audits, and special reviews. Our work is directed by the Legislative Audit Commission, which is a commission that's made up of three members from each caucus in both the House and the Senate, and that composition is always the same, regardless of the party composition of the legislature. We have wide jurisdiction over anything that state government does or state government funds. And we also have access to all data and documents of any classification, public or not public, in order for us to do our work. So we are an important, we view ourselves as a really important resource to the legislature for its responsibilities in terms of making sure the state government does the best job it can for the citizens of Minnesota. And with that, let me move into our presentation. Here's a kind of a quick overview of where we're going. But before I get started, I would like, as Chair Pinto said, this is the first time we've presented this report to the legislature, I would like to acknowledge the work of the other members of my team. Caitlin Zanoni-Wells is behind me as one of the members of the team. Also on the team were Eleanor Berry and Don Hirasuna, and this presentation reflects all of their work as well as mine. I'm going to give you kind of some brief background and talk about child protection and about the decentralized system that Minnesota has. And then at the suggestion of the chair, I'm going to pause for a minute and kind of take some questions in the middle to see if there's any kind of background questions before I move into our findings and recommendations, which have to do with law enforcement holds, with prevention of removals and placements and reunifications.
And members, I'll maybe note, I kind of felt like we could use Mr. Kirshner's presentation to build on Ms. Sunderman's to teach us all a little more about this system. So he's going to teach us a little more, and we'll pause and see if folks have questions at all, and then kind of dive into the findings and recommendations from the OLA report itself. So please, Mr. Kirshner, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, looking at Minnesota's laws, there are kind of two overarching goals that appear in Minnesota's laws, and they appear in multiple different places in the law. And those two overarching goals are protecting children's safety, making sure that children are safe from situations that might endanger them, and keeping families together as much as possible to have children be in their own homes with their own families as long as it is safe for them to do so. However, given that we're sometimes dealing with families that are struggling a lot and are in crisis, it is sometimes difficult to balance those two priorities, and that is the challenge that faces our child protection agencies, our courts, and others that work in this system. The world of child protection has many components. There are many different circumstances that child protection comes up in, and there are many different responsibilities that folks have. And I have kind of listed a whole bunch of them on this slide. Child protection encompasses children that are at risk in the home because of their parents' actions or inactions, but it also encompasses children at risk outside the home, for example, in educational or religious settings. Children who pose a danger to others, whether other children or to other adults, children who run away, children who are persistently truant, all of those kind of fall under the umbrella of child protection. And there are a lot of different responsibilities that folks that work in this area have, including screening in reports of maltreatment to see if that is something that needs to be looked into further. Assessments and investigations, as Ms. Sunderman talked about. There's education and outreach responsibilities. There are services that are provided to families to try to prevent things from getting to the point where a child needs to be removed from the home. There are but sometimes we do reach the point where there is that level of danger and a child does need to be removed from the home, and there is the decision to do that, and then the decision about whether or not to return the child to the home if things have improved or the situation has changed. And, of course, the whole area of foster care, how we care for children when they are outside the home. Our report did not look at everything on this slide. We specifically focused in on a very specific set of situations when children are at risk because of their parents' action or inaction, and that specific decision about when to remove children from the home and the decision about whether it is safe for them to return. That is what we focused on in our program evaluation. Now, it's important to point out that in Minnesota, and this differs in different states, but in Minnesota, child protection agencies, and by that I'm referring to the divisions of the county social service agencies that are in every county, child protection agencies do not have the independent authority to remove a child from the home. In Minnesota, that authority is given only to law enforcement officers who can remove a child for an emergency hold, a 72-hour emergency hold, for courts who can remove a child for an emergency hold or for a longer period of time. And, of course, the parents can always choose to have the child go elsewhere. So those are the only folks that are authorized to take the child outside the home. Child protection agencies cannot do so independently. Any long-term placement of a child outside the home has to be authorized by a court. That is not something that anybody else can do. It has to go through the court system. When there is an emergency hold, there are three paths that can be taken, and this is a simplified version of a chart that we have in the report on page 35 that has a little bit more detail in it. But once there is an emergency hold, one of kind of three things can happen. First of all, local authorities could decide that the danger either was not there in the first place or that it has gone away or has reduced significantly. And so the child could be returned back to the home before even a court hearing occurs. And this might, for example, happen if there is a particular adult in the home that presents a danger to the child and that adult is removed from the home, for example, through law enforcement activity, and then the child is safe to return to the home. But then there would not be that court hearing that might occur. The other thing that can happen is there can be a court hearing. It's called an emergency protective care hearing. And when that hearing occurs, the court examines the circumstances and decides whether or not the child should return to the home or whether the child should be taken or continued outside of the home for a longer period of time. And as I said, only a court can determine that child should be outside the home for that longer out-of-home placement. The third possibility that can happen is that the parents might agree that the child be placed outside the home. That is a voluntary placement, and that's a little different from the other two. Among other things, when that happens, the parents have the ability at any time to say, actually, we'd like the child to come back. And if, for example, the child protection agency disagrees, we might then go back to a court hearing to have a discussion. But you can have a voluntary out-of-home placement, and that does occur from time to time. As I said, once a court has ordered an out-of-home placement, it becomes the court's responsibility to decide what happens after that. Only the court can decide that the child is returning home. So a court order can only be reversed by another court order. And only the court can determine how that placement ends. Now, I want to move on and talk about Minnesota's decentralized system because it is somewhat unusual among the states. Minnesota is one of only 9 states that does child protection at a county level. That it is not something that we have an overarching state agency that provides child protection services. It's in fact done at the county level, and different counties have different initiatives and different approaches to how they do it. This means that local officials and local courts, or rather district courts, have substantial discretion in how they provide child protection services. And the ways in which child protection services are provided in, say, Yellow Medicine County may be different from how they're provided in Washington County, might be quite different from how they're provided in St. Louis County, based upon the philosophies of the people providing the services, based upon the resources available within that county, based upon a variety of other things. I will also note that some services, and this we're talking particularly about law enforcement, and as I said, law enforcement do have the ability to remove a child from the home. Those are not just at the county level, but at the local level. And you may have differences within a county. For example, in Ramsey County, you might have differences in how services are provided between the St. Paul Police Department and the Maplewood Police Department and the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. All have might have slightly different approaches to child protection. So you have a lot of different local actors involved. And you have many different entities that have roles within the child protection system. You have attorneys that might represent parents and children in court. You have the county attorneys, in some circumstances, tribal attorneys. You have the county child protection agencies, district courts, and sometimes tribal courts are involved as well. Guardians ad litem, who are individuals that act for the court to look out for the best interests of the children. They're appointed by the court to not represent the children as attorneys, but to represent the interests of the children before the court. Law enforcement agencies, as I mentioned, the Minnesota Department of Human Services plays a very important role, particularly in terms of funding a lot of these services. And then when children are enrolled in American Indian nations or are eligible for enrollment, you may have tribal representatives involved as well. So you have this all this panoply of individuals involved trying to provide services and trying to provide assistance to the children and families who are caught up in these circumstances. You have all of these different individuals, and I want to point out that you don't have one central location at which oversight happens. In fact, you have a lot of fragmented oversight. The Department of Human Services and the Federal Children's Bureau have significant oversight because of the amount of funding that they provide, but generally they're looking at kind of system-level outcomes, not individual cases. If we're talking about what happens in an individual case, that oversight comes from the courts, from the district courts. But as I mentioned before, there are circumstances in which child protection actions are taken, but things don't ever actually make it to the court because a decision is made before it gets to that court hearing and the child is returned to the home. So then you don't have court oversight in those particular types of cases. And there is no real entity that oversees the work of law enforcement agencies with regard to child protection, even though they have that very important role of being one of the authorities that can actually decide to remove a child from the home. So we have a very kind of fragmented, decentralized system within Minnesota. Lastly, let me before I get to the end of kind of the overview, I want to just point out some recent trends. In 2019, just over 6,000 children were removed from homes in Minnesota. That is a number that had gone down somewhat in the previous couple of years. I think the peak was in 2016 or 2017. The most common reasons that were cited as primary reasons were caretaker drug abuse and alleged neglect. However, you'll note on that slide, I gave the percentages there, that if you add up those percentages, you only get to about 50%. So you have a lot of other reasons that are out there that are listed for children to be removed from the home. I will note that there are also secondary reasons that are listed in the data, and drug abuse and neglect are listed as secondary reasons a lot of the time. But there's a lot of different circumstances that go on in these types of cases. In Minnesota, as in other states, American Indian and African American children are more likely than other children to be removed from the home. That has been true for decades. It is something that people have pointed out for decades and have worked on for decades, and it is it has been a problem that has proved kind of somewhat intractable, but it's something that that people in this policy sphere are well aware of, and a lot of people have spent a lot of time examining and working on. And lastly, I will note that in Minnesota, law enforcement holds are the most frequent form of removal, although there are certainly many instances in which the way in which a child is removed from the home is that it's through a court case first, that the child protection agency goes and does a petition to the court, and the court requires the removal from the home. So that is another path. But law enforcement holds are the most common. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to pause for just a second before I start talking about our findings and recommendations to see if legislators have any questions about that kind of brief overview of the child protection sphere.
Yeah, Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I think I just want to point out, because I'm not sure that this committee really understands where we are with our Native American children. We're actually number one in the nation for removal of Native American children. The last I saw, 17-1. That's horrific. And so my question is, and maybe we'll get into it, is there has to be some sort of tribal notification anytime there is a child who potentially has any lineage to a tribal nation. And so when you were doing this overview, are we going to see how we did in that notification piece? Because I do think that that plays a huge role. Well, I know that it plays a huge role in our Native children being placed outside with non-Native families.
Mr. Kircher.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. And it's a great point. We did not look very specifically at that notification piece, so that's not going to be a part of my presentation. I will note that the that Minnesota is number one in the country. Minnesota is certainly very, very high, and the disparity between between American Indian children and other children is marked in Minnesota. However, the comparison between states is kind of an interesting thing because of how the data are reported. The thing is that states can choose to report or not report instances where a case is transferred to a tribal court. And some states choose not to report those numbers. And so a lot of those children are not included in the data that are provided by other states. Minnesota does choose to report all of those numbers to the federal government. So that number one in the nation is, that may be true, but it's actually something that we couldn't confirm. We looked at that, but we couldn't confirm because of the differences in what the federal government requires states to report, and because some states can leave out those children that go through the tribal court system. There may be states that are not reporting those instances. So that's just something to note about that figure.
Thank you.
For the question.
Mr. Kirchner, while folks are thinking if they do have anything to ask, do you know the other states that are decentralized, those nine? Do you happen to remember which ones those are? If not,
I believe I have a feeling we have a footnote on that in the report. Let me. Let me see if I can.
And I don't mean to.
Yeah, no.
You're looking at that. Yeah, the I'll note members, you know, we have, of course, counties of such wildly varying population sizes and resources, et cetera. It is interesting that ours is one of the few states that sets it up that way. I don't mean to freak out anybody who represents a county who may be listening to this, but that is just, you know, notable, I guess, that our state sets it up that way, and that could pose some challenges for oversight, though, on the other hand, obviously has some benefits for local flexibility as well. Mr. Kirchner, you got an answer?
I do not. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I thought we had a footnote on that in the report, but we don't. But we can certainly provide that information to the committee. I just don't have it at my fingertips.
No problem at all. Thank you for that, for providing that. And then I had a question about, maybe we can go back to your slide 7, I guess it is, when you talked about, you said that in most cases police, most cases it's police who are doing the removal in the majority of cases, and there's not oversight of that. I'm wondering about where it says the court holds a hearing. Is there any, I guess I hadn't thought about this in my work as a prosecutor, if police remove a child from a home, I guess the court is simply going to say, is there any sort of review at that hearing in any way of what the law enforcement has done by taking the child out of the home, if
right.
I understand what I'm asking?
And this is a question we asked, and our sense was the answer is not really. That, in other words, if the court determines the child can go home, the court says the child can go home. But are there consequences if the law enforcement agency acted out of turn? Not really. I mean, other than you might get an admonishment from the bench, I suppose, but there's not really an oversight function in that sense that courts exercise. You could, for example, have instances where a family could, for example, file a tort claim. You know, basically that their harm was done to the family by the actions of the police, as you might for other instances where police act inappropriately. But there wouldn't be there's not really an oversight approach that we have.
I guess I'll note that that's true in other aspects of policing as well, as it is, in fact, for other aspects of certain public employees, we have a pretty broad protection against liability in those circumstances. So it may not be unusual, but just for us all to be sort of thinking about in that way. And there's other ways in which police interact with civilians where there may be limited oversight, and then others. In any case, that's helpful. Thank you. And then I just wanted to, still looking to see if folks raise hands at all. I'm just kind of wanted to highlight for folks, if we can go back to your slide 13 then. As you noted, I mean, nearly half these circumstances involve do not involve abuse of the child, physical or sexual abuse of the child necessarily. They involve, would involve, I guess, neglect, caretaker drug abuse, and alleged neglect. I should first just pause and see if I'm understanding that right, Mr. Kirschner.
Well, what I said is that if we're looking at, in the data, if we're looking at the primary reason that is listed in the data for why the child is removed, half of those times it's either drug abuse, it's either substance abuse or neglect. Okay, and then the other half the time, there's a lot of other things that are listed, and those can range from sexual abuse, physical abuse, the child basically not being at home, being abandoned, or a wide variety of different circumstances. And to some extent, this will vary somewhat because we have a locally driven system, whereas, different counties might actually record the reasons in different ways that might be different from the way another county would record some things in a similar situation, because, one county might say, oh, well, that's abandonment, and another county might say, well, the reason that they were abandoned is because the parent was dealing with a substance abuse issue, and so they might mark it as substance abuse. So I want to be cautious about about reading too much into exactly what the numbers mean, but it is certainly the case, and we looked at over 150 individual cases and read through the files. There's a tremendous variety of circumstances, and you have a lot of parents struggling with a lot of different things. There's not one story that is true across the board.
Okay, thank you. And I should just note before I call in Representative Hudson, I did receive the list of those nine states.
Oh, thank you.
California, Colorado, New York, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. That's helpful to know. Representative Hudson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kirschner, I'm wondering if you can provide much insight into the experience of a 72-hour hold initiated by law enforcement. What happens with the child? What type of setting are they placed in during that short period? Is there any communication or notification of parents and what have you?
Mr. Kirschner.
Thank you very much, Representative Hudson. It's a great question, and the answer is it depends a little bit on the circumstances of what's going on, right? But generally, one common experience, let me put it that way, not the only experience, but one common experience is you might have, let's say we'll talk about it as a law enforcement hold. You might have law enforcement that is called to a location, and you have an instance where the child is in danger. You have, for example, a parent, let's go back to what I mentioned before, a parent who is under the influence of a controlled substance and is not able to provide care for the child. And law enforcement will say, this child cannot stay here under these circumstances. And so the child would then be taken to some other location, and that would vary to some extent, but frequently you would have an instance where you would have the Child Protection Agency would be in contact with law enforcement, and you might even actually have Child Protection Agency on staff. It depends if it's in the middle of the night or at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the Child Protection Agency will have a list of emergency locations where a child can be taken. They would have families that provide emergency foster care. And so that child or those children might be taken to that family and said, you're going to stay with this family for a couple of days while we try and get things sorted out. And so the child would be taken in by that family that provides emergency foster care and would be in that location for, a day or two until we get to the end of that 72-hour hold period, at which point there would be a determination of whether or not the child could return back to the home, or the child could be placed with somebody that the child knows better, right? So let's say, for example, you have grandparent who is in another city in Minnesota, and the Child Protection Agency calls grandparents. The grandparent drives down and, like, the next day takes the child, and then the child is in foster care placement with the grandparent until the situation can be resolved. So that's one example of how things work out. But you have a wide variety of circumstances. You have children that are newborns in hospitals, for example, and then you have a whole different sort of things. You have teenagers that have run away from home because of abuse or other types of circumstances, and that's another set of situations. So it really can vary from situation to situation. But what I just framed out is one, I would say, not atypical story. If does that help?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does help. As to the notification and communication piece, I'm curious as to what, if any, rights the parents have to know where their child has been placed. Surely there's probably circumstances where that information would not want to be shared. What's the status quo there?
Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Hudson. I think you're absolutely right. It depends to some extent on the circumstances. There may be instances in which it feels that it is not in the safe interest of the child for the parent to know where the child is placed. I don't feel like I have at my fingertips exactly what the process is, and that makes me feel that it might differ slightly from one county to another in terms of the exact practices that are used. Parents certainly have the right to know that their children are in foster care, and there are expectations, for example, that the parent will be able to visit the child when the child is in foster care and so forth. And parents have the right to be represented by an attorney. That's actually a very new thing that this legislature passed in 2021. Up until that point, parents could be appointed an attorney, but it was not necessarily a right. But that is something that is now a right as of 2023. And they have the right, of course, when there's an emergency protective care hearing, to be in court and to testify about the circumstances that have led to that situation. So, but as far as what parents know about where the child is placed, I don't feel like I'm not sure of the answer to that. So I will try and provide a little bit more detail to the committee on that rather than speak out of turn.
Well, I'll maybe note if there is somebody in the room who has answers, can help answer any of these questions, come on up. But otherwise, yeah, if you can please, Mr. Kirshner, provide a follow-up, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. Representative Hudson, further on that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for the report. I actually read it this summer. And had a question then that I'm going to ask now. I see a lot of information about disparity around race, but I know the University of Minnesota has done some research around disability status of children and out-of-home placements. And I was wondering if the report looked at that at all or if we have any updated data on kind of those pieces, because I did note in the report that you have like 7% is related to the child's mental health or behavioral issues, and when you combine the mental health and behavioral issues together, it's actually a pretty big number. And so wondering if we have any data about that intersection as well.
Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. It's a great question. It's not an area that we looked at closely in our work, but I think it's a great question. And I mean, it's a very big area of policy, and there are a tremendous number of areas that one could drill into more deeply. We did not look specifically at disability, as I recall. I'm wishing one of the other members of my team was here who was the data person, because she might have some stuff at the top of her head. I will check with her to see if we looked at those numbers, and it just didn't make it into the report.
And for folks who are new to the legislature, which is a number of us, what we can do is we'll have testifiers send information, and then I will send out to you all and to members of the public as well. So, yeah, Mr. Kirshner, if you can do that in response to these questions from Representative Hudson and Hicks, then we'll send them out to everybody. other questions from members at all? Yeah, Representative Nelson.
Yeah, I'm just thank you. Just kind of wondering, on the 72-hour hold, is that kind of between the if the child gets placed back in the home, who makes the decision on it? Is that the courts? Is that the law enforcement? Is that CPS? Or, you know, where's the decision making in that?
Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. The answer is yes, actually. It is all of those. The law provides that a variety of different entities can make that decision, whether or not the child's ready to return to the home. It can be law enforcement. It can be the Child Protection Agency. If it goes to an emergency protective care hearing, it can be the court. So all of those are answers. And, in fact, I believe, I want to say county attorneys also can make that decision as well. So there are a variety of the law provides for a variety of those folks. In practice, what we found is that typically it is the Child Protection Agency that makes that call. It was rare that you would find that a law enforcement agency would make that call. I think it would mostly be in instances where there was a really obvious, easy way in which to do that. Let's say, for example, you have a parent that is driving drunk. And the law enforcement pulls over the parent with the children in the car and says, well, you cannot stay with this parent. Other parent comes from home, gets the children. Law enforcement's not necessarily going to check in with Child Protection Agency on that if it's just a matter of providing, you know, sending the children home with the other parent who's sober. So there are instances where that happens. But most of the time, Child Protection Agency is the one that makes that call, unless it gets to a court hearing. Once it goes to a court hearing, then it becomes the court's decision, the court's call.
Representative Nelson, looks like you're covered.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from members? I'll just highlight, I feel like a deep underlying tension of what we're talking about was on one of the earlier slides, Mr. Kirshner, between the safety of the child and family preservation, which on your slide was phrased in terms of welfare of the child, but of course there's also the piece of parental rights as well. And I think it's really easy in the issue of child protection to kind of swing wildly between, on the one hand, we want to protect children, of course, from situations that impede their development, and we're very concerned and want to, you know, dive right in. And on the flip side, being very concerned about an overreaching government separating the relationship between parent and child unnecessarily. And between those two extremes, right, it's a very challenging, complicated thing to figure out what to do. We know that very often it's in the best interest of the child to retain a relationship with the parent, with the family, absolutely. And so how do you make that work? It's a complicated, challenging area. Good. So not seeing other questions, so it sounds like it's time to dive into your findings and recommendations then, your next couple sections.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So I want to talk first about more about law enforcement holds. This was something that we did focus on because local practices regarding law enforcement holds vary really widely in different places around the state. I have a chart up on the right side of the slide here, this is an overview of a map that is actually in the report on page 30, where you can actually drill down into individual counties and your individual areas. But if you look at the different county human services agencies, more than if you look at that chart, at the top of the chart, 12 of those areas, more than 80% of removals began with a law enforcement emergency hold. So that's one end of the spectrum. And then at the bottom of the chart, we have another 11 entities, almost the same number, where less than 40% of removals began with law enforcement emergency hold. So you have, you know, kind of a 2-to-1 difference. So there's really differences from place to place around the state in terms of whether or not law enforcement is the kind of the primary means of removing a child from the home. And that really has to do often with, kind of local custom and tradition. There's not really reasons for it that we could particularly frame out. One of the things that we would have liked to do was to present you with more information about specific law enforcement agencies. And we found that we were unable to do that. We could not find anybody who keeps track of which law enforcement agencies do carry out those holds. That is, we can tell you the number of law enforcement holds that there were in Hennepin County, but we cannot tell you how many law enforcement holds were done by the city of Minneapolis or the city of Brooklyn Park or the city of Bloomington or the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office. Nobody seemed to collect that information. That's something that that concerned us greatly, considering that this is one of the most intrusive ways in which law enforcement can interact with families and with children. We also noted that there are no requirements in state law for ongoing training of law enforcement on these powers that they have. Law enforcement officers are required to be trained on child protection at the start of their careers when they're at the academy, maybe in their first year on the job. But after that, there is no state requirement for ongoing law enforcement training on child protection issues. We also noted, in addition to the kind of the input end, that the what happens afterwards also varies significantly from county to county. And I have here on the slide a chart that looks at the percentage of law enforcement emergency holds that were followed where no further out-of-home placement happened. That is where the court where there was not a court order for longer out-of-term placement. And again, we have great variation here in Beltrami County. Practically every time law enforcement removed a child from the home, that child was placed in longer-term out-of-home placement. It was, you know, over 99% of the time, right? In Washington County, at the other end of the spectrum, over one-third of the time that law enforcement removed a child from the home, the child was returned to the home within that 72-hour period, either by decision of the Child Protection Agency or by the court. So really substantial differences and really substantial variation from place to place around the state.
Can we just pause on that for a second? And I'm actually just at the moment thinking less about the county variability, just making sure I'm really understanding. So like in Washington County, there'd be this assessment. Maybe it's the case that there just need to be a separation for a couple days if you assume that sort of the removal was appropriate, if we assume that for the moment. But then saying when the child returns home, is it possible that there's still services being offered to the family? Can you sort of talk about the circumstance where that might happen, where a child's being removed for a couple days but being brought back to the home, and kind of what the range of possibilities are there?
Yeah, and the range is very wide because there are so many different sorts of circumstances that might be involved. Mm-hmm. But yes, there definitely may be instances where services are provided to the family, and then that helps the child to remain in the home. Typically, what has to happen is that the Child Protection Agency works together with the family to produce what's called a safety plan. This is what needs to happen in order to make sure that the child is safe, right? And sometimes it can be a very straightforward and very simple thing. There is an adult in the household that presents a danger to the child. We will send the child home if we can be guaranteed that that adult is somewhere else. Everyone's like, okay, we'll do that, right? It's very simple. It's like, sometimes there are services that need to be provided to the family, and sometimes that can be done. We talked with one child protection agency that told us about a story where the children were removed from the home because the home was overrun with vermin, okay? And then what they needed to do was needed to find another place for that family to be. And then it was okay for the children to be in that home because you did not have mouse and rats everywhere. That was a situation where the agency was able to work together with the family to come up with something different that then allowed the children to be returned to the home safely. There are lots of different other types of circumstances. It really depends on what the specific instances are of the situation that comes up. But does that give you a kind of a idea of the range of possibilities?
That is helpful. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, yeah, please continue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So we have two recommendations here with regard to law enforcement holds. First, we think that the Department of Human Services should be tracking which law enforcement agencies are providing these holds. We think that's a really important information both for stakeholders and for the legislature to have because that would help us to provide better understanding of the information on this slide. Like, that Washington County information is really interesting, and I would love to know whether there's, like, a difference between the Washington County Sheriff's Office and the Stillwater Police on that, right? But I don't know that because that's not information that's collected. So there would be useful information there. I'm sorry, I have a
Mr. Chair.
I'm just wondering on that data, it's interesting, and I'm wondering on that data for when you're looking at police officers' holds, would there be reporting that also shows if it's whatever the percentage is, the reasons for the hold? Is because when you look at child protection, I would assume after caring for seniors my life, vulnerable adults are, it's for the safety of the child. So are we dealing with drugs? Are we dealing with no food, no heat, no parent in the home? What is it? So that it's not just a police reporting, but what is the child's risk as a vulnerable child?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Kirshner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Representative, for the question. We do have that broad information that I mentioned earlier where we had 26% was drug abuse and 23% neglect. Those are kind of reasons that are put in by the child protection workers. They choose from a menu of possible reasons, and they say this was the primary reason, these were the secondary reason. With regard to what the law enforcement officer based their decision on, that is not collected in any place. So you would need to go to each individual law enforcement report, basically, and read those, the narrative reports that are filed by law enforcement officers at the time. It's not collected that we're aware of at any county level or state level.
And I just want to clarify quickly, I'll go back to Representative Lesnikar. Are you saying, Mr. Kirshner, that the officer moves the child, then immediately the child protection worker is looking at that, and then they're choosing the reason that, in a way, the child protection worker is choosing the reason they think the law enforcement officer removed the child, essentially.
That is my understanding of how it works, that you have law enforcement officers who are conducting activity, and then you have child protection workers that are putting information into the system that DHS requires them to put into, and then that is the broad kind of data that we were able to look at.
Representative Lesnikar, please.
Yeah, it seems to me to be a logical pathway that if we're going to look at numbers of police interactions, that we're looking at the raw data. What is this data? And there would be some format of a simple checklist for them to fill out. So we have the actual data on it is, because the ultimate goal is to protect children. It isn't the data of the police. If the children are at risk at a higher level in a county, that would be helpful to know. So we can look at programs and you know, there's so many different situations that their professional judgment is being used every day. And you could have a person who's a single parent and she's in labor and there's no one to watch the kids and there's no family. So who's going to watch the kids? That would be a 72-hour hold, I would guess.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't know all that data, you know. And so I think that would be great, helpful.
It's a really interesting point, Representative Lesnikar, because it sounds then like essentially the reason is identified. It's just being identified by a different person who may be sort of making a guess. So I wonder if one recommendation might be that rather than the child protection worker choosing the reason, it really should be the officer who made the choice to remove the child who then identifies the reason. I think, Representative Lesnikar, hopefully that's kind of consistent with what you're asking about.
Yes.
Yeah. Any comment on that, Mr. Kirshner?
Thank you very much for the question, Representative and Mr. Chair. And I think that's an excellent point. I will note that we don't. It would be an interesting approach to require police officers to provide data to the Department of Human Services about decisions that they made in terms of the course of policing. I don't know if there is a precedent for that within state government. I don't know exactly how that would work, but I think it's certainly worth exploring because, as we point out, these are officers that we have authorized to carry out this really important function of state government, and there isn't a clear kind of reporting path or oversight path that all comes together centrally for what all of these different officers are doing.
There are certainly many examples, though, of law enforcement collecting data about the things that they do. As you say, it hasn't gone to this particular agency, but it certainly goes to others. I do a lot of that work in my work as prosecutor. So, Representative Lesnikar, happy to work with you further on this. This might be something that would make sense to
do.
Representative Lesnikar, please.
I just appreciate the data, but I think it's important that we understand what the data is we're collecting.
Mm-hmm.
What are we measuring? Because the goal is child protection.
Absolutely.
If there's a child at risk, we need to know and protect the child. And hopefully, obviously, reuniting them with the family is a goal, the number one goal for all children. But we want to know they're safe. I think we all agree to that.
That's really helpful. Thank you. So, Mr. Kirshner, seeing if there's anything else from anybody, this is helpful information. And so please continue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'll just move to the second recommendation on this slide. We were concerned about the lack of ongoing training for law enforcement officers in this important area, and we recommend that the Department of Human Services convene a working group to look at what ongoing training law enforcement officers should have. One of the things that we think is important about thinking about it in terms of a working group rather than us making a direct recommendation to the legislature that there be a specific requirement is that we think there might be real differences between law enforcement agencies that are worth thinking about. For example, when you have larger law enforcement agencies, it might make sense for certain officers to become specialists and have like extra types of training and serve as resources within their departments, whereas that might be less appropriate or feasible when you have smaller law enforcement agencies that only have, you know, a dozen or fewer officers. So we think that there's opportunities there for some deep thought about what should be required for ongoing training. I want to move on to talk about efforts to prevent removals from the home, because clearly the best approach to child maltreatment is preventing it from happening in the first place. Under state and federal law, child protection agencies must make efforts to prevent reaching the point of removing a child from the home. And the standard in law is what are called reasonable efforts. And the thing is that reasonable efforts, although that is the standard in law, is not something that is very clearly defined in law. And so you actually have courts that kind of have to interpret, you know, what were reasonable efforts? Were they provided? And that is something that we did a lot of looking at. We looked at, as I said, about 150 different cases where we read through all of the information in those files surrounding the removals. And we found that it really varied from court to court in terms of what they listed as reasonable efforts and in terms of what sorts of things were I just realized I'm jumping ahead of what's on this slide here. The types of different things that they looked at. Before I get to that, though, I do want to point out that there is a separate standard in state law with regard to American Indian children, which is called active efforts, and that is something that is much more clearly defined in law, particularly in state law. That's a very clear list of things that need to be provided, list of things the agencies need to do before they remove a child from the home when the child is an American Indian child. And so that applies to American Indian children, but for all other children, it is the reasonable effort standards, which, as I said, is much less clear. Now I'm getting to what I had jumped ahead to, that we found that courts accepted many different activities and levels of activity as reasonable efforts. And in some cases, we were reading the court orders, and they just simply said that reasonable efforts occurred without listing in the court order what those efforts were, which made it difficult for us to determine what the court had used as a standard. So, as I said, wide amount of variation here and a lot of different reasonable efforts that were provided, a lot of different prevention efforts that were provided in case to case. We have a chart in the report on, I'm going to find it real here quickly, on page 43 of the report, where we just listed a whole variety of the things that we saw listed as reasonable efforts across multiple different cases. Now, we would have made a recommendation with regard to prevention and reasonable efforts, but we did not do so, and the reason for that had to do with the fact while we were doing this report, there were changes happening. And that is in 2018, the federal government passed the Family First Prevention Services Act, and that was being implemented at the time that we were doing our report. But we were looking retrospectively at cases that had run their course. And so both DHS and the judicial branch are responding to this federal law by taking additional steps to address prevention efforts. But the cases that we were looking at, because they had happened a couple of years earlier, we could not see those implementation of those new efforts. So we weren't able to look at the extent to which those changes that were being put into place moving forward affected the cases that we were looking at. So we simply made a broad recommendation to both the judicial branch and the Department of Human Services to pay closer attention to preventive efforts, because we certainly could see instances where there were differences, there was that variation that I was talking about. But we were not able to look at how those entities had implemented the new federal law and had done new work based on prevention efforts going forward.
Mr. Kirshner, I feel like it's useful to make sure we're clear on when you say preventative efforts. I guess I'm thinking if nearly half of removals are because of drug abuse or neglect, you describe a family living and there's rats and mice in the mm-hmm. home, then presumably preventive services is helping people to deal with their addiction, to help make sure they have the food. If it's neglect, make sure the food and shelter, that kind of thing. Is that the sort of thing you're talking
Absolutely,
about?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. And one of the things that's very important about what the federal government did is that it had been the case that federal money went toward providing services to children who were taken outside the home, money for foster care, right? And that what had been the case up until 2018. That's where the money went. And what the substantial difference that occurred with regard to the Family First Prevention Services Act was to provide more federal money for services that might occur before you got to that point, that might be the services that we provided to deal with the vermin problem or to deal with the drug addiction problem or to deal with other types of problems that families that are struggling are having, so we don't get to that point of having to remove the child from the home. The idea is if we're only funding services that are provided after the removal has happened, you know, we're fixing things after the, you know, the horse has already left the barn. Let's try and provide services before we get to that point. And that is something that's been a shift in terms of the federal funding, and both the Department of Human Services and the judicial branch were then taking steps to take advantage of the new abilities that they could do certain things before they reached that point of removal. But we weren't able to look at those because our information was retrospective going back into the past.
Would there be any value to making the neglect statutes, to revising them in some way to provide more direction to child protection or law enforcement?
I think that's an excellent question. I will encourage you to talk about that question with the Department of Human Services and with child protection agencies. I will broadly say that the child protection statutes are very complicated, and it is one of those areas of law in which a lot of things have gradually been added over time. And so you have a lot of interlocking and difficult to kind of parse out pieces because stuff keeps getting added on, but there isn't as much stuff taken out. So I'm sure that the chair is aware of other parts of law that are like that as well.
Well, and I'll note, I don't know if you all noticed during the early childhood presentation from Ms. Mock, we had that series of programs that all do very, very, very similar things. And so I think there's a lot of our jurisdiction has this problem of having been built up over time and not necessarily a stepping back and having a system that gets built up and makes sense. That's helpful. Thank you. Continue to look for hands up. And so, Mr. Kirshner, please keep going then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last section of my presentation, I want to talk about placements of children outside the home and the reunification process. Let me first start with some overall data. For more than half of removals, in the data that we looked at, children were reunified with a parent or placed long-term with relatives within 2 years of being removed from the home. We also noted that out-of-home placements with relatives, as we show in the chart on the slide, increased between 2014 and 2019. That is, children were more likely to be spending more time with relatives when they were outside of the home at the end of that time period than they had been before. And we noted that that increase was particularly marked with regard to African-American children and Hispanic children, that significant differences between those children and other children that we saw in the data in 2014 had been reduced notably by the time we got to the 2019 data. So that was an area in which we thought it was important to point out that some change had been occurring, that more children are being placed with relatives more often, and that's been particularly true for children from those communities.
Mr. Kirshner, how about indigenous kids?
I have that information, but I will have to find it. I believe that it was there was less disparity there, but I'm going from memory here. Let me find that really quickly.
It would mean that maybe we started off with less disparity, I hope. Though that's a question based in profound ignorance, so I could be totally wrong. I'll just note for members that, you know, it makes sense that being with family, as research shows, has much better outcomes for children if that's at all possible. So even if a child can't be with a parent, being with a relative, and that makes sense, I think, to all of us that be the case. So we want to have.
Yeah, I will find that information and provide that to the committee. I believe we have it in the report. We'll check for that, but if not, we'll provide that to the committee.
Thank you, because that's gratifying that for our kids of color, for some of our kids of color, there's this increase, you know, being placed much more with relatives. But we want to make sure that that's true for for all kids.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to talk first about the courts just a little bit here. The judicial branch does have performance measures that it uses to assess the performance of district courts. And it has some specific performance measures with regard to child protection. And we generally endorse, I mean, we're the Legislative Auditor's Office, we generally endorse the use of performance measures in assessing whether or not agencies and state offices are doing the work that they should be doing. However, we noted that the performance measures that the judicial branch uses, and when we talked to judges, they told us they paid attention to these measures and felt some pressure to have good measures on them. But we noted that these measures were really very focused on time, on how quickly cases were expedited through the system. However, courts have a lot of responsibilities that are not related to just expeditious processing of cases. That courts are required to make sure, that, for example, that people have attorneys. Courts are required to make sure that child protection agencies are providing certain reports to the court. Courts are provided to, are required to make sure that American Indian tribes are notified when there is a case before their court that involves American Indian children. And these were not things that the courts were measuring. We have a recommendation to the judicial branch that they consider some additional performance measures, thinking that performance measures certainly do have an impact on the activity that takes place. We are glad that they have some performance measures, but we think that they could go beyond just simply the expeditious processing of cases and think about whether or not they could do some other performance measures that are related to other responsibilities that courts have. We also looked at the information that is provided to parents when a child is removed from the home. And we found that in our review of cases, that the information that's provided to parents, at least in writing, is often lengthy and complicated. Child protection agencies are required to provide case plans for each child that is outside the home. These are often long plans. They're 20 to 30 pages long, provide a lot of detail about things like schooling and health care and lots of other things. And somewhere within them are the requirements for what the parents need to do to try to move toward reunification. And you might have multiple case plans if there are multiple children involved in the case. So you might have a parents that are receiving, you know, the blizzard of 120 pages of paper of information regarding their case. Plus, there's all of the court orders, and some of those can be lengthy and complex as well. And we felt that these are parents that are often struggling. That's one of the reasons that they are in the child protected with the child protection system in the first place, and it would be really best if there were more simple information provided to parents, particularly about reunification. And that's where we have a recommendation to the legislature that we believe that the legislature should require child protection agencies to provide simple, one-page, this is what you need to do to move toward reunification. There should be a summary provided to parents that tells them, this is what the court's requiring, this is what you need to do. So our recommendation is that the legislature put such a requirement in law to require that level of clearer communication. Now, I do want to suggest, note that we did not look at every single county in the case. There may be some counties that are doing this already, but it's a county by county system. We didn't see it, at least. That's something that we thought the legislature could step in and require for all child protection agencies. There are a number of other things in my report, but that is where I think I will stop at this point, Mr. Chair, and take further questions. So once again, thank you for inviting us to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Kirshner, and Vice Chair Keeler, and then we'll go to Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair. We have a whole lot of questions. ICWA is something that a lot of us are really dedicated on. So I guess moving forward, it's going to be something that I and this committee are going to be asking a lot of questions about and digging into. So I guess, I mean, that's here now. I mean, that's what we're going to be doing. And so can you, I think I just need you to walk through that Beltrami number for me and what that really means, and then I'll ask a follow-up. It's the one on slide 16, please.
Yep, I'm happy to move back to that.
Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you for the question, Representative Keeler. And to start with, what it really means is something that would be difficult to answer without doing an in-depth look at Beltrami County specifically. But I will first say that what the specific statistic says is that in Beltrami County, when there is a law enforcement removal of a child from the home, it practically always leads to a longer out-of-home placement. That is, the child is placed into foster care for some longer period than just that original 72-hour period. That's what this number particularly means. I will also note that we did actually interview Beltrami County child protection officials as a part of our work. And one of the things that they told us is that in Beltrami County, because there are so many American Indian children, they have taken the approach in Beltrami County of using active efforts on every single child protection case, regardless of whether they know that the child, at the time that the case starts, that the child is American Indian, because often it comes up later. And they've just decided they're just going to do active efforts all the time. So that is something that that county has chosen specifically to do, is to hold themselves to that active effort standard in every case. At least that's what they told us. So that's a piece that I was told. I'm not sure what addition, when you said you want me to drill into it more, what other questions do you have?
Representative Keeler.
So my concern with that is that Beltrami County includes Red Lake and Leech Lake Nations. And if you talk to them, I am sure that they have a very different answer. We also know that Beltrami County is one of the poorest, highest poverty communities in the nation. And so what my concern is also that, one, we're basically taking kids out of poverty-driven homes, but not actually addressing the system around poverty that's happening there. I don't believe in what the county is saying in their direct relationship with the tribes, because we just met with the tribes. We are in direct contact with the tribes on a regular basis. And I don't believe that that's true. So I do think that we need to address that. And I think that's where this whole idea that our counties are the ones that are leading the charge in our children creates a mass concern for me. And so I'm not going to wrap that all the way around, but I think everybody kind of gets where I'm going, that that's a prime example. And they're not in 100% compliance. When we did our ICWA compliance, Beltrami's not 100% compliant. If they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, every county would be 100% compliant. My last thing that I want to say is, when we do police removals, do you know how many of those are taking kids out of the school system? Because when I used to work in the school system, we would have police officers show up on a Friday and surprise a kid from school and be like, surprise, you're not going home, you're coming with me. And the long-term outcomes that we have in education systems and that child's relationship with school is dramatically impacted too. So then now we're creating a generational impact, because now you're creating a next generation that maybe will most likely live in poverty or have those same struggles. So not sure there's really a question in there. I just want to make sure that we're like grounding this information and understanding that it's not always just the child and the parent and their issues. There are massive systematic breakdowns here that I really hope that we can address moving forward. Thank you for your time and your information.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Keeler. Mr. Kirshner, it looks like you have something brief,
if you
can.
Yeah, thank you very much for the comment, Representative Keeler. One thing I did want to note is that we did talk to several tribal nations in the course of doing our work as well. I will note that we treated those conversations as information-gathering conversations. We were very clear that we do not have authority to evaluate tribes. But we did want to find out what their experience was working with the child protection system that we do have the authority to evaluate. And so we did have a number of those conversations.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Kirshner, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for setting this up for us. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kirshner, wondering, you know, we saw some data based on race, on removal of from the home for children and stuff. Is there anything, whether maybe income level or poverty level, you know, is there any data on that we know of?
Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. Yes, there is data on that, and I will direct members. There's a report that is put out by the Department of Human Services, and I want to call it the Out-of-Home Placement Report. I believe that's what it's called. I see a representative nodding at me, I guess, who's familiar with the report, so thank you. But there are a lot of statistics in that report that break down numbers in a variety of different categories, and that's something that we didn't, reproduce, since that is something that the Department of Human Services already produces. But I'm pretty sure that there are income numbers in there. Generally speaking, as Representative Keeler said, we're often dealing with families that are struggling financially. That should not be, a surprise, I think, to most of us, that that's often where these families are from. But there are certainly instances where children are removed from more affluent families as well. But that's not the majority, I believe, of cases.
Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. And so Representative Coulter. And we'll have to keep it quite quick.
Yes, I will do my best, Mr. Chair. I just, you know, I think, and we, there are a lot of things that we didn't really touch on today, including, as you mentioned, some of the programs that are state-funded or federally funded and county-administered. But I think one of the sort of supreme challenges I think that we're going to see in this committee is how many of these programs, how many of these services are administered by 87 different counties across the state, and what that means just by virtue of living across county lines. Sort of pick an extreme example. If you live in New Prague, Main Street in New Prague is the county line. So if you live on one side of Main Street, you're in Le Sueur County and has that had that infrastructure to deal with. You live across the street, you're in Scott County, which is a much larger, more suburban, just different county. And so I think one of the real challenges we're going to have to, we really have to take on, and as somebody with a background in local government, I have a tendency to sort of bristle at the state coming in and telling the locals what to do. But I mean, this, I mean, just the presentation we've seen today, this is one of the most stark examples, I think, of how that system is just not really working for a lot of folks, and in particular, a lot of kids, and in particular, a lot of kids who are already struggling, who are already facing a lot of challenges. And I hate to get too emotional at my second or third committee hearing, but we just got to do better on this. This is, it's just not working for folks. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Coulter. I'll note members, I don't think there's any area that's sort of more important than this one, fulfilling some sacred duties to keep kids safe and to hold families and et cetera. So extremely important. Really appreciate everybody's attentiveness to this, and Mr. Kirshner, for your work for the Office of Legislative Auditor. I want to set up for members for Thursday. We're going to be hearing a presentation from an economist on child care and early learning, and then hearing our first bill. And the plan is to hear that bill, do all the consideration, but we're going to wait to have an actual vote on that bill until a week from tomorrow, a week from today, I guess it is. So that's the plan. Folks should be in touch if you have questions at all on that. You see, any final questions before we get out of here? Thanks. With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.